Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Drew Courtney of People for the American Way, who discusses his group's opposition to President-elect Donald Trump's proposed Muslim registry and his nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions to become U.S. Attorney General. Investigative journalist and author Greg Palast, who explains why he believes the GOP cross-check system was used to wrongly purge some 1.1 million Americans of color from the voter rolls, changing the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. And Kyle Bailey of the Committee for Ranked Choice Voting, who talks about Maine voters' decision to make theirs the first state in the nation to adopt the ranked choice voting system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Syrian military launched a new assault on the rebel-held eastern section of Aleppo in mid-November. The bombing campaign came after weeks of relative quiet. New attacks targeted a hospital, a blood bank, and killed dozens of civilians in the besieged city of 250,000 people. Syrian volunteer first responders in eastern Aleppo, known as the White Helmets, have won praise in the Western media and among human rights groups. But while the White Helmets maintain they are non-political humanitarian workers, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his allies charge that the group is in the pay of the West, faking their rescue work close to extremist factions like the Islamic State and Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, formerly known as Jabhat al-Nusra. The White Helmets were founded in 2013, during the early days of the Syrian civil war, as the need arose for search teams to rescue people trapped in collapsed buildings destroyed by bombing. The group was nominated for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Thus far, 11 million Syrians have fled the violence of their nation's civil war, many seeking refuge in Europe. With Donald Trump and his radical right allies coming into the White House, the National Rifle Association is planning to push for a federal right-to-carry law that would allow tourists in the future to carry concealed firearms in places with strong gun laws, such as New York City. Trump, who himself has a concealed carry permit, endorsed gun reciprocity laws in the Republican Party platform. This would allow a gun owner with a concealed carry permit to bring a gun into all 50 states. Gun control advocates, many who supported Hillary Clinton in the election, call the push for reciprocity laws a threat to public safety. States have widely divergent policies on what is required to obtain a permit to carry a concealed firearm. Out-of-state visitors in New York City, for example, are regularly arrested if they are found to be carrying a gun with a permit from a state with weak gun regulations. Now that the Republican Party controls all three branches of the federal government, many gun control activists will focus on strengthening gun regulations at the state level. Nicole Hockley, whose son Dylan was slain 4 years ago at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, reflected, "This is where we double down on our efforts. Regardless of who is in office, people are still dying every day, and there's an opportunity to save lives." The police slaying of Philando Castile in a suburb of Minneapolis this summer hit close to home for St. Paul resident Michael Claiber Diggs, a black professional living in a biracial marriage. The couple lives in a predominantly white neighborhood near Falcon Heights, the community where Castile, a popular school cafeteria worker, was shot by a police officer. 4 months after the shooting, which was live-streamed on Facebook by the victim's girlfriend, prosecutors have charged police officer Geronimo Yanez with manslaughter and two other felony charges in the case. Claiber Diggs is often followed home by police cars after he drops off his daughter for dance class. Yet his wife, who is white, attracts no such interest from the St. Paul police. The contrasting experience of blacks and whites in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area is an echo of the racial divisions often found in cities like Baltimore and Chicago. While the alarming pattern of police shootings of black men since Ferguson has focused renewed attention on racial tension, the question of segregation is usually ignored as a source of violence. Natalie Moore, who wrote a book about segregation in the South Side of Chicago, told the Christian Science Monitor, "Segregation is the common denominator we see in these communities. If we are going to effectively address race relations, we must address our separateness." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Throughout the 2016 presidential election campaign, GOP candidate Donald Trump, now president-elect, trafficked in racism, hate speech, and scapegoating of ethnic and religious minorities. The many days of anti-Trump protests in U.S. cities and towns after he won the state-by-state electoral college vote, while failing to win the popular vote, were inspired in part by Trump's campaign promises to deport 11 million undocumented Mexicans in the U.S. and build a wall the length of the U.S. southern border. The real estate billionaire also pledged to ban the immigration of Muslims into the U.S. and institute a national registry for Muslims already living in America. Concern about the new Trump administration's intention to move forward on establishing a Muslim registry was fueled by statements made by Carl Higbee, a former spokesman for a major super PAC backing Trump. Higbee, speaking on a Fox News program, said that the mass internment of Japanese Americans during World War II was a precedent for the president-elect's plans to create a registry for immigrants from Muslim countries. People for the American Way is one of a large number of groups opposed to the Trump agenda that are gearing up for important political battles ahead, many relating directly to the feared erosion of human and civil rights in the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Drew Courtney, communications director with People for the American Way, who explains why he believes a Muslim registry is unconstitutional and the reasons his group has come out in opposition to Trump's nomination of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions to become the next attorney general.
One of the things that we're reconciling ourselves to in the Trump administration is that it's sometimes very hard to know exactly what's going on because, of course, Donald Trump will say one thing and then say something else and then deny he said the first thing. Although, unfortunately, given the appointments that we've seen and the moves towards policies we've seen so far, some of the worst things that he's proposed need to be taken very, very seriously. So we've heard since he was elected from various advisors, folks on the transition committee, folks like Rens Priebus, who have a role in the White House, that there is consideration of some kind of Muslim registration. He was saying that they're not ruling out something like a Muslim registry. And we know that on Sunday, Kris Kobach, who right now is the Secretary of State of Kansas, but who has been a longtime anti-immigrant and anti-voting rights activist, who has in recent years also become quite a vocal anti-Muslim activist, was in with Donald Trump and was proposing to him to resurrect and expand a program that existed under President Bush that would have required Muslim immigrants from certain countries to register. You know, fundamentally what it comes down to is any attempt to create a registration of Muslims is profoundly unconstitutional. And you can dress it up by saying, oh, well, we're actually only asking people from certain countries, wink, wink, to register with the government. That fig leaf shouldn't fly. It's still profoundly offensive, and it's also really dangerous. But we do know that that's being considered. I think that this is something that we should really worry about. You know, if there's one thing that's essential to the Constitution, to the First Amendment, to the 14th Amendment, it's the idea that all people are equally welcomed in our civic life. There is no exception for Muslims. There is no exception for Jews, nor for Christians, nor for atheists. And this would run, you know, deeply afoul of that principle. And the other thing to remember is that these kinds of registries do nothing to keep us safe. They actually make it much more dangerous for all of us for several reasons. You know, it buys into this very dangerous lie that's being propagated by the Islamic State, by Al-Qaeda, that the United States is at war with Islam, is at war with Muslims. This is a powerful recruiting tool for them. It also attacks communities who we need to help us, finding extremism. You know, there are people who are radicalized within the Muslim community, and what we see is that the people who alert us to this so that that problem can be addressed are other Muslims. And the third thing is that it blinds us to radicalization that goes on in other communities. we've had some very dangerous terrorist attacks in the United States. Many of them have been committed by people who are not Muslim. When someone shoots up a black church in South Carolina, that was not committed by a Muslim. When someone blows up the federal building in Oklahoma City, that was not committed by a Muslim. And shame on us if we decide that we're going to look so hard at Muslims who are radicalized that we ignore other folks in our communities who can also become radicalized with really deadly results.
Drew, I'm sure you and your colleagues at People for the American Way and other allied groups are talking about mounting effective opposition to a prospective Muslim registry in the United States, hearkening back to the internment of the Japanese. What are some of the strategies and tactics you're talking about to effectively oppose this possible policy change in the country?
So I think some of the things that we need to be seeing right now at the policy level before we're moving on to it is that there's a lot of activist energy on the streets, on Facebook. I've been working at People for the American Way for over a decade. I've never seen anything like the energy and enthusiasm that's come out in response to this, to pushing back. And I think a signal needs to be sent loud and clear that we are watching, and we're watching very closely on these kinds of things. So the first place that I think it really is important that we push back is around the nomination of Jeff Sessions. He has a truly abominable record around civil rights. He has an abominable record around Muslim Americans and has spoken repeatedly and kindly to groups that are not just anti-immigrant, but specifically anti-Muslim. And it's really important that we fight very hard on that nomination. And that, frankly, if senators are going to make the choice to rubber stamp someone as extreme and dangerous as Jeff Sessions, they pay a price for it. And they need to know that this is not going to be a real fight. The second thing is that we need to oppose very stringently the first moves that we see on these things. So when we see this starting to come out, if these things get floated, if we see something like someone like Kris Kobach moving in, we don't wait and see on some of this stuff. We speak up for our values immediately. The thing that I think we need to remember is not only do we have to oppose it then when times could be tough, but we need to fight every single way in the less dramatic, less glamorous ways to make sure that we never, ever get to that point.
That was Drew Courtney, Communications Director with People for the American Way. Find more news and analysis on Trump's proposed Muslim registry and growing opposition to the nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The victory of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump in the 2016 U.S. election was a shock to his supporters and opponents alike, due to the critical mass of statewide and national polls that had confidently predicted a win for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Exit polls, too, had forecast that Clinton would be the next president, but discrepancies between exit polling and actual vote totals led many observers to suspect that the election outcome was somehow rigged in favor of the GOP. Civil rights advocates had long charged that the Republican Party had effectively instituted voter suppression laws in 21 states after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2013 gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. These new laws included restrictive voter ID regulations, reduction in the days and hours of early voting, obstacles placed on registering new voters and accessing absentee ballots, all designed, critics charged, to make it more difficult for minority and young citizens to vote. While some of these laws were challenged and overturned, opponents charged that the chaotic changes in election rules led to confusion and lower voter turnout. Greg Pallast is an investigative reporter and award-winning author who uncovered the 2000 Republican voter purge in Florida that led to what many charge was a stolen election, where the U.S. Supreme Court intervened in the disputed vote count and appointed George W. Bush as president. In his new documentary film titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, Pallast investigates a multi-state system known as cross-check, supposedly designed to check for voters who had registered more than once and to prevent fraudulent multiple voting. Your reporter spoke with Pallast, who explains why he believes the cross-check system was employed to wrongly purge some 1.1 million Americans of color from the voter rolls, many in crucial GOP-controlled battleground states that could have changed the outcome of the election.
One of the biggest factors in the loss of Hillary Clinton, and remember, it's not a loss. This is one of the things we have to understand, while Clinton not only won the popular vote, she won those exit polls in every one of the swing states, which is odd because our State Department considers exit polls the gold standard of a measure whether an election is honest. So if the official numbers, as they did in Peru and Ukraine and in Serbia, disagree with the exit polls, the official vote is discounted as fraudulent. So what happened here? Do we have a fraudulent vote? And the answer is yes. And here's why. And how could it be different? How could people walk out and you have a different count? We have about 5 million votes, 6 million votes in America, which are never counted. And you go, what? Yes. People go in and get something. Their names are missing from the voter rolls. So they're given something called a provisional ballot. Then the ballot's thrown out because they're not in the voter rolls. We have ballots which are invalidated and thrown out, and then absentee ballots invalidated and thrown out are what they call spoilage. There's about 5 million of these votes, and the chance your vote will spoil or be invalidated, according to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, is about 900% higher if you're black than if you're white. This is the core. And so when people walk out to the exit pollsters, they answer honestly who they voted for. What they can't answer is, did your vote count? About 6 million votes didn't count. Overwhelmingly, those are minority voters who voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. Now, how does that happen? How do these votes get invalidated? That's where we get to this new game called cross-check that's in the film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Actually, all these games are, but this is the center of the investigation in the film. A lot of discussion in the papers today and yesterday about a guy named Chris Kobach, who is the probable Homeland Security chief for Trump, one of his earliest and most stalwart allies, quite a brilliant guy, currently the Secretary of State of Kansas, which puts him in charge of the voter rolls there. Who cares about Kansas, except that he was able to convince the other Republican voting officials, 30 other secretaries of state, to give him their entire voter rolls, so he could hunt for the double voters, and he stuck them all on the computer. They literally took all the names of American voters in Republican states, ran through the computer, and did nothing more than match their first name and their last name, and completely ignored the fact that, for example, it was Maria Cristina Hernandez and Maria Isabel Hernandez, and that was meant to be one single voter. And you'd say, well, they can't be one voter. They're two different names. It doesn't matter. They both stood to lose their vote, period. And so the result is that they knocked off about 12% of the people on the list. About 1.1 million voters showed up on Tuesday, and their names were not on the voter rolls. So they either went away discouraged or they filled out these provisional ballots. And if your name's not on the voter rolls, even if it's removed for the wrong reason, you can't have your ballot counted. You lose your vote.
Well, Greg, what are the prospects that there'll be some kind of investigation given the evidence you accumulated of this cross-check system and the millions of votes that were expunged from the rolls that had a profound effect on the results of the 2016 election? Is there any interest in Congress in investigating this? Any other third-party organizations stepping up to take a good look at what you found here?
The Congressional Black Caucus has demanded an investigation by the Justice Department. Alcee Hastings actually handed my documentation, a copy of the film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and a copy of my Rolling Stone articles to the Attorney General, put it in her hand and said, now you got it. You can't say you didn't get it. I want indictments. He said that before the election, by the way. And Keith Ellison has signed on to maybe become chairman of the Democratic Party. We could say maybe that'll blast things open. ACLU is preparing litigation. The NAACP in North Carolina under Reverend William Barber has already filed a suit citing cross-check. Suits are being formulated in Ohio. And I hope that there will be congressional hearings. But I got to tell you, the problem is that the U.S. press really, really hates this subject. You can't get a word of this in the New York Times or the Washington Post, the Pravda and Izvestia of the American elite. They're literally afraid to touch the subject.
That was investigative reporter and author Greg Palast, whose new documentary film is titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. Find links to Palast's investigation and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com. www.clintonmanifesto.org. On Election Day, Maine became the first state in the nation to approve a ballot measure establishing ranked choice voting, also known as instant runoff voting. It's a method that enables citizens to vote for the candidates they really want, and to rank other candidates as their second, third, or even fourth choices for any given elected office. A number of cities across the U.S. already use ranked choice voting, including San Francisco, California, Portland, Maine, Tacoma Park, Maryland, and St. Paul, Minnesota. The ballot measure was organized through a citizen initiative called the Committee for Ranked Choice Voting that collected 62,000 signatures to place the referendum question on the November 8th ballot. The group built a broad-based coalition that included the League of Women Voters of Maine, Maine Citizens for Clean Elections, and other allied organizations. The ranked choice voting system will apply to races for Congress, governor, state house, and Senate seats, as well as party primary elections. The push for the measure was inspired by the fact that in 9 of the last 11 elections for governor in Maine, the candidate who won received less than 50% of the vote, with third-party candidates often labeled as spoilers. Many Mainers came to believe that the winner-take-all voting system stifled their voices because they felt forced to vote for the lesser of two evils, a familiar refrain across the U.S. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kyle Bailey, campaign manager with the Committee for Ranked Choice Voting. Here he explains how the newly approved voting process works and how RTV could reduce negative campaigning, which hit new lows in the 2016 presidential campaign.
So with ranked choice voting, you no longer have to vote for a lesser of two evils. You have the freedom to vote for the candidate you like best, without worrying you'll help to elect the candidate that you like least, knowing that whoever wins is the candidate who does get to a majority. They have to build a coalition beyond their base, reach out, talk to more voters, listen to more voters, ask them to be part of their coalition so that when they do get elected, they also have a mandate to govern, bring people together, and get things done. So an extraordinary grassroots movement that brought together people from across the political spectrum to win nonpartisan election reform. Putting more power in the hands of voters, giving voters more voice and more choice in our democracy, isn't a liberal or conservative idea. It's not a Republican or a Democrat thing. It's something we can all get behind because it improves our political process. And if we want better outcomes, if we want to break some of the dysfunction and gridlock and hyperpartisanship in our politics, we've got to change the way we elect our leaders. And that's what voters in Maine did here last Tuesday, was deciding to adopt ranked choice voting and overhaul our election system so that we get better results.
Kyle Bailey, be very explicit, if you would, about how the process works.
Sure. So with ranked choice voting, you no longer have to choose one candidate when there are three or four or five or more running. You get a chance to rank them from your favorite to your least favorite. So you have a ballot that gives you the opportunity to rank your first choice, and you fill in the oval next to the candidate you really like the best. And you get to say, all right, of these other candidates, which is my second choice? If I couldn't have my first choice, who could I live with? Who could do an okay job, my second choice, et cetera? You can rank as many or as few as you like. And on election night, we add up all the votes to see who is everybody's first choice. Who do you like the best? Not who is your strategic choice and voting against someone, but who do you actually think is best for the job? If one candidate gets a majority of first choice rankings, they win. But if no candidate has an outright majority, then we look to see which candidate's in last place. They're eliminated, and we have a runoff between the remaining candidates. So let's say we have a three-way race for governor. There are three candidates running. No candidate received 50% plus one in the first round. And so we look to see which candidate's in last place. They have the smallest pile of ballots cast in their favor. That candidate is eliminated. But if you like that candidate the best, your vote's not wasted. We literally look at your ballot to see who is your second choice, pick up your ballot, and move it to the pile for one of the two remaining candidates. So it's an instant runoff, and if your favorite candidate, you know, advances that instant runoff, your vote continues to count for them. So ranked choice voting works just like actual runoff elections without bringing voters back to the polls 4 weeks later, having four more weeks of negative campaigning, without disenfranchising overseas voters, including servicemen and women, for whom it's difficult to participate in an actual runoff election but can fully participate with ranked choice voting. So it's simply a better way to conduct runoffs. It's more efficient, more cost-effective, and enfranchises more voters.
You said you want to educate candidates that negative campaigning could backfire. How so?
Well, when you have, let's say, what we have in Maine right now, what we've had for the last 40 years, we'll have a race with three or four or five candidates. The incentive of the candidates is to energize their base, turn them out to vote, and beat the heck out of their opponent so that they can hold on to their 35 or 37% of the vote and knock their opponents down just below that. But with ranked choice voting, you can't do that. With ranked choice voting, you need to get to 50% plus one. And most of the time, unless you're wildly popular and a majority of people's first choice, you've got to be able to reach out and get first choice and second choice rankings, and in a really crowded race, even potentially third choice rankings to build a majority coalition. And so you have to reach out and talk to more voters as a candidate. So both the current and former mayor of Portland, Maine, where ranked choice voting has been used now since 2011, they both won and lost under ranked choice voting, and they talk about their experience running for the legislature years ago under first past the post, or the way we've been voting at the state level, and what the experience was like running for mayor of Portland with a ranked choice system. And so the difference for them is when they were running for the legislature, if they'd see a lawn sign for their opponent, they'd skip that door and go to the next one. But with ranked choice voting running for mayor of Portland, if they saw a lawn sign for their opponent, they'd go knock on that door and talk to that voter and listen to that voter and hear what they had to say and try to find common ground, because if they couldn't be that voter's first choice, they wanted to be their second choice, knowing that they might need enough second-choice rankings to build a majority coalition. And they also knew if they put out a nasty mail piece or a television ad that personally attacked one of their opponents, voters who liked that other candidate best will be less likely to rank them as their second choice. And so negative campaigning can backfire with a ranked-choice voting system. And Rutgers University did a great study in 2014 comparing and contrasting American cities with ranked choice voting and American cities without it, and found that voters and candidates in places with ranked choice voting reported on average a 40% decline in negative campaign. And that's not just voters, that's candidates saying, I got less mud slung at me with a ranked choice voting system. So I think that's a pretty profound and hopeful outcome of this system as well.
That was Kyle Bailey, campaign manager with Maine's Committee for Ranked Choice Voting. Find links to the group's website and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.